It's February 15th, 2008, and this is 508, a show about Worcester. Benedetti. I'm here with a new podcast setup. Hopefully we're sounding as good as ever. And today on the panel is Brendan Mellican and Bruce Russell. How are you guys doing?
Pretty good.
Excellent. Thank you, Mike.
Bruce, we haven't talked to you in a few weeks. Let me ask you, how much are you benching these days?
Close to 300 now.
That's incredible. Now, your arms are getting huge. If anybody ever runs into you on the street, they should totally ask to see Bruce's arms. Is this free weights or is it a machine?
Free weights.
You're benching 300 free weights? I'm gonna pay for a guest membership one of these days and go in there with you and witness this and maybe take a photo, because that's pretty impressive, man.
That is impressive. Where do you work out, Bruce?
The YWCA.
That's awesome. The first thing of the week probably to talk about is the rescheduling of the trains in and out of Union Station.
This is really the silliest thing that I've seen in a long time. It's like anyone who's taken the trains going out of Worcester to Boston, the commuter rail, knows that they're frequently not on time. And it's not like a huge delay. Usually it's you know, averages around 10 minutes or so. So the powers that be came up with a solution for this delay. Instead of making sure the trains are on time, they just spread out the time frame that it supposedly takes to get from Worcester to Boston. So like they spread out the schedule itself. So they added 10 minutes onto the time that it's going to the train is scheduled to come. Widened the arrival and departure schedule, and said that this is a solution. Which if they're going to do that, they might as well just get rid of time.
Oh, come on!
Just say that the train will be here on.
Oh,
Thursday.
Come on! I'm 100% in favor of this. I say under promise and over deliver. You know, I mean, if you can't keep the trains on time, then I mean, just be honest with the customers. There's no reason to have every.
Oh no! There's no doubt that needs to happen. But the bigger problem is that there is still an ongoing problem with access to
yes,
rails.
Yes.
And we have trains, commuter rails, moving at 10 miles an hour through the city of Worcester. And that's the bigger problem. And you can add as many minutes as you like onto the schedule. It's not going to fix that.
Right.
Problem.
And for people who don't take public transit, you know, there's a systemic problem with commuter rail in this country that passenger trains always have lower priority than freight trains. So the freight system, anytime there's anything going on with the freight system, the entire commuter rail system is just thrown into disarray. Yes, Bruce?
Yeah, I got something to add.
What's
about
that?
That, actually. Back in 1998 – when I used to go to Manhattan like two times a week, well, down where the North Station is, actually where the bus were actually like 84 and 85
okay.
is, I used to wait there until like, I don't know, 3 o'clock in the morning until actually for the bus came back. More than I realized that there was a bus leaving the Port Authority at 11:30. That was like gate 23. So I missed it by one minute. So the following Thursday when I was there, in the same week, I caught that bus at 11:30 at K23. Well, here it is, like, and after, I don't know when they stopped doing this, I think it was like 99 or so, 2000, they just got rid of all those, like, those little lower numbers. And when Peter Pan and Greyhound merged together, they cut all those routes out. So the only bus you can actually get there now is still down at the gate 82 or 83 now, so... And it's as absurd that you have to go to Boston to wait 2 hours to go to Portland, Maine. It makes no sense. I mean, there's like one time I was going to take a Amtrak, and it was checking in Amtrak to go to New York City to do my last song on the last CD I did. And I said, well, you basically have to go all the way to Boston to come back and get to New York. I mean, this is like, I might as well just take a flight to London to come back and go to California. I mean, it makes no sense. But you know, this is America. What sense when the things make sense here, man?
That's the biggest problem with these schedules, though, Bruce. Is that you know, like, I've got a lot. I work out in Watertown, and I've got a lot of friends that work out in you know Metro West and Boston and whatnot. And I think it's about 50-50 between those of us that drive and those of us that take the train in. And for me in Watertown, there really is no stop. In nearby like Watertown, it's on the other side of Newton, so especially in the winter, it'd be really difficult to, you know, to get from the station to where I actually work. But the bigger problem is that it takes almost twice as long to get to that stop via train than it does to drive. it's not a really good incentive for me to leave my car at home, and I'd love to. But, I mean, at this point, it actually almost costs a little bit more than it does for gas, and it's going to take me longer to get there. It's just, if we actually are in this state, you know, at all really concerned with alternative means of transportation, it doesn't seem like that's actually the case. We don't do a good job of showing that to the average commuter.
Because it's like one time, well, I don't think it was like 2 weeks ago, I was like, they're like talking about Kyle's like cutting the local bus here and cutting and losing all his buses out to West Boylston and stuff like that because of budget cuts. I mean, you know, it's like everybody, there's a whole, there's like everything, it seems like everything in America is always about money. I mean, isn't there anything that anybody else is worried about? But it's always like one little, if there's a dollar too short, then let's just cut everything out. I mean, I don't have any sympathy for it. It doesn't make sense. So, I mean, you know.
Well, let me change the subject to a political topic for a couple of minutes here. One actual interesting piece of fallout from the recent Super Tuesday elections in Worcester is that Grace Ross is now the co-chair of the city committee for the Green Rainbow Party. There previously being no city committee in the city. You know, I've talked before about how I'm basically ready to resign from the Green Rainbow Party over some stupid stuff I've seen them doing on the state level. And I don't know. I guess I'm willing to give it a couple more months and see if maybe on the local level people can't, you know, get some sort of progressive organization together that's serious about winning elections. So there you go.
Sure.
I wanted to also – what else do we have here? Oh, I wanted to also mention briefly something that I've complained about in the past, which is about getting a connections exceeded error on the city's website when I was looking up documentation. Now, I've gotten this error down through the recent months, maybe over the past year, every once in a while. Never really sure why. Recently, I started getting it a lot. And I realized that the reason I started getting it a lot recently is because you have to have cookies turned on in order to use that site. So this doesn't explain all of the problems that I've had, but it explains 95% of them. So I don't know why the city website requires you to have cookies turned on. That doesn't make any sense to me at all, but there you go.
And I'm gonna try and keep this tame. I promise to keep – I'm not going to mention any names here other than the author of this story, but this could turn into a bit of a rant, so feel free to punch me in the face verbally and get me to stop anytime you want. But on the 11th. Clive McFarland over at the Telegram had what was actually a pretty good editorial, but took a really weird direction while I was reading it here, and it was regarding the strip club zoning that's going on in the city, and I'm sure everybody's familiar with this subject now, and I can guarantee we'll be more familiar with it as time goes on. This one is going nowhere fast. Clive had one really interesting line that was his words and not a quote, and it was his perspective in his editorial. And this was it here. Cities and towns cannot bar such establishments on the grounds that they are immoral or reprehensible, but can restrict their operations as a way of eliminating or reducing criminal activities. I read that, and it kind of flipped my lid. Let me stop for a second. I love strip clubs. I think the sex industry is actually pretty spectacular. And that's my own personal opinion. I think when people say that it objectifies women and whatnot, I think that usually comes from people that have never been in a strip club, because the only things that are ever being objectified in a strip club are men and money. And it's actually, I've also been friends with quite a few people who work in the adult entertainment industry, and I've found from personal experience that it's oftentimes one of the most empowering aspects of their lives. Quite, you know, the opposite of what tends to be conventional wisdom about strip clubs and any aspect of the adult industry. But this line here that was discussing that, you know, a city can't bar an establishment based on immoral or reprehensible, it just seemed so asinine that in 2008 a writer would actually state that a city should be able to legislate morality, or because a city finds something distasteful that it should be banned. I was really taken off I was thrown off base when I read that. And then it really got me thinking that, you know, out of all the strippers that I've known, and I've known quite a few, and I mean like as friends, not as customers, like getting close to people, and you know, they're just like any other people. You know, if you took your average group of strippers, they're probably no different than your average group of teachers. It's just another segment of the population that has a different job. But one thing that is almost universally true that I have found with people who work in the adult entertainment industry is that there's a lot of broken souls there. And I'm really starting to get offended in this city in particular when I hear politicians waxing poetic about how we need to get rid of establishments like this, within our own ranks time and time again of elected officials. We have elected officials who have no problem coming out and publicly supporting, you know, priests who are actually convicted of sex crimes against children. We have politicians who have publicly admitted to beating their wives and then convincing their wives coming out and saying they deserved it, and we reelect these
people that
over
disgusts.
And over again. And we've got we all know about politicians who have made a spectator sport, a hobby of trolling bars for underage college girls and plying them with booze. And there's no we all know this. But yet, we then turn around, and we never stop to think that that's where the adult entertainment industry comes from. Like, that's where its employees come from. You know, women who are literally destroyed by men. Or, you know, just completely obliterated by men from a social perspective. And then we turn around, we have the audacity to blame the industry for existing. You know, it's like there isn't some, like, mysterious stripper factory off in Ohio, you know, that produces strippers and sends them off to Worcester. You know, we create this industry. Little cities like Worcester that are so homogenous and so closeted in its activities that we're able to do things that are essentially illegal, just a hair below the surface and nobody minds, this is the stripper factory. This is where all those broken souls come from. So for all of those politicians that really think they're on some sort of moral crusade, look at your peers before you start criticizing, you know, some woman who just has a job and is probably feeding kids with that job. Even though you may be personally offended by the sight of her breasts, she's really not hurting anybody. But there are many elected officials in the city who are.
I have never been in the habit of hanging out in strip clubs myself, just like I don't hang out in casinos. So I always feel a little bit weird telling other people, you know, where these industries should be, because there's something that I'm not really interested in. But I wanted to mention that this week at the city council meeting, there were about a dozen people there just in case the strip club zoning came up to a discussion, which it didn't. They just moved it into a committee. And a couple of these people were my friends who were there to oppose this. And a couple of these people who were my friends who were there had never really been to a city council meeting. And they were a little bit disoriented. So it was sort of fun to, you know, point out the players and help them figure it out. And I wrote up a little page on the Worcester Activist Wiki called How to Attend a City Council Meeting, which I'll link to from the show notes. And anybody who's been to more than a couple of meetings might want to go on there and add your own thoughts, because I think it is kind of an opaque process. Not, you know, and, you know, your city councilors and whoever are, like, overjoyed to help you navigate this opaque process. But I just wanted to throw that out there.
It is funny whenever you bring someone new down there, because there are no instruction manual. Well, until you just wrote one.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people bumping into each other saying, you know, do I get to say something? You know, that's always the first question that people ask me when they've never been there before. Do I get to talk?
Right.
You know, it's like everyone wants. Yeah, it's funny that people don't really get how it works.
I know. Well,
you know, I heard that
Father Rich Reedy, who I believe his official title is the rector of St. Paul's Cathedral, he was down there. He's been sort of a leading voice on this. And he left relatively early, I think, realizing that nothing was going to happen. So, you know, there's definitely people involved in this effort who are totally 100% clued in, but there's also a lot of people who are just mystified by what's going on.
What is their feeling down there at St. Paul's, Mike?
You know, they don't want to see any expansion of any adult entertainment in the city. I think that that's pretty clear. I mean, I haven't talked to Father Reedy and said, what's your position? But I'm 100% sure that's his position there. And it was an interesting collection of people who were there to speak out against this. You know, some neighborhood activist people, most of whom I think of as pretty lefty. Some of my Catholic friends who are much farther to the right. So I don't know. I mean, there didn't seem to be any group of people there who I picked out as these are strip club owners. There could have been. I have no idea what, you know, who there would be.
Probably not. It's not. Yeah. I mean, and you know, Brendan, the guy who owns Seven, is probably one of the most unassuming guys in the world. So if you did see him down there, you wouldn't. Now he wasn't going to be wearing a big fur coat and a giant.
Right.
He's not going to pull out the red rug after he gets out of his limousine.
There you go.
Yeah. You know, the thing is, I actually right now am hoping more than anything that Brendan ends up doing a full court press on this from a constitutional perspective, and, you know, does have his lawyer take the city to task. It's not so much a matter of, like, expansion of zoning. it's really at this point it's a matter of clarification of where the city stands on basic constitutional principles. And we actually have a situation right now where the city refuses to acknowledge very, very simple, basic constitutional principles in terms of zoning regulation. And it's not any more complicated than that, which is unfortunate. You know, and when I said half-jokingly that I love the adult entertainment industry, one of the problems that I have is that here in Worcester, that view of adult entertainment oftentimes includes burlesque and cabaret, some pretty tame things that, you know, are pretty universally accepted as being, you know, cultural institutions, not seedy aspects of the adult entertainment industry. I think it's actually really interesting that Brendan down at 7 has never formally declared what his intentions are down there in terms of an adult business. And I have a funny feeling that he's just shooting for really high-end burlesque, but doesn't want to limit himself because, you know, that's not fair to the process. We've got a broken process right now.
Well, I heard that they're going to put that script club down where the former Paracinema was. But, I mean...
You know, that's a funny thing you just mentioned that, Bruce, because I have a friend that lives right off of Pleasant Street, and he was telling me that last week he was walking down Tammany Hall, and at night there was a work crew inside the old New Art Theater, you know, which is what was the other porn theater that was on the bottom of Pleasant Street, right next to Tammany Hall. And it was in the middle of the night. He said there was like scaffolding going up, and that there was actually work crews inside the place. So I'm wondering if one of those two locations is actually being looked at as a possible location and an easy way to get around this issue without anyone ending up in court.
Yeah, because I heard some guy, some lawyer was in the middle of this whole thing about the strip club downtown. And he was going to say, I heard this is just. What I heard, so that he was like kind of feeding it the way they were gonna like sue the city or some crap like that. So that's just you hear all these kind of stuff all the time. So you know, it's like whatever happens.
Yeah, so Bruce is the city's fly on the wall who just happens.
He's everywhere. Our friend Anthony Mora, who is in the midst of a self-declared hunger strike to highlight what he believes is the Mossad's complicity in the 9/11 tragedy. And he wrote a really bizarre blog post, and he writes a lot of stuff I wouldn't recommend at all, but this is a pretty amazing one because it gets into a bunch of stuff about our friend and occasional panelist Cha-Cha Connor. And of course this podcast and it's just amazing. I talked to her, and she confirms that this incident did happen where he ran into her at an ATM, and for some reason he totally freaked out. Because he's been writing a lot about this hunger strike that they're doing. I wanted to just throw out there for people who are fasting during Lent or who are interested in this stuff, what I believe is the big difference between a hunger strike and a fast in the style of Gandhi, which is that a hunger strike is when you say, you know, if I don't get my way, I'm not going to eat. This is a concept familiar to anyone who's ever been 6 years old. And I don't think hunger strikes generally work. Sometimes if you're in prison and it's going to cause trouble for the warden or it's going to draw unnecessary attention to the conditions in the prison, it might work. But basically, people who don't agree with you tend to be very happy that you're starving yourself to death. It doesn't really do anything. Now Gandhi, on the other hand, when he would fast, it might be, for example, that there had been a big demonstration for Indian independence and it broke out into a riot. And he would say, well, apparently I'm a bad leader of the Indian independence movement. Apparently my own conviction in nonviolence is not strong enough. It's not making it out there to the people. I really need to refocus myself, you know, regenerate some of my spiritual focus, some of my spiritual power, think about what I'm doing and recommit myself to this. And then he would fast and pray for 2 weeks. And so on the one hand, he was doing this mostly for himself, but if it was targeted at anybody, it would be targeted at his own supporters, who would then say, well, maybe we shouldn't riot today, because if we riot, Gandhi's going to fast for another couple of weeks and he's getting skinny enough already and we worry about him. Cesar Chavez did the same thing. Whenever there would be violence associated with migrant farm workers, he would say, apparently I'm being a poor leader. I need to fast for a couple of weeks and pray and refocus myself and recommit myself to this cause. And this is, for example, this is exactly what we've been doing every noontime at the cathedral and at the courthouse in our prayer and fast against the Iraq war. But this is not a hunger strike to my mind. This is not us saying, oh, we're going to starve ourselves until the president changes his mind on something, because that's not obviously not going to work. this is really just saying to ourselves, we need to focus, we need to change our own hearts, and maybe become more effective advocates for our cause.
And when you just said that the guy freaked out when he went, when she went to the ATM machine, maybe it was the best. Maybe that's the idea. The only action the guy had.
The only act. I don't know what was going on at this ATM. Yeah. Apparently, he just sort of growled at her. She didn't even know who he was. But maybe, this was somehow. He's very vague about exactly what he thinks happened at the ATM. He starts off by trying to number his facts alphabetically, and he gets to fact B, and it kind of, his argument kind of collapses, and then he starts over with fact one. And he has five facts, one of which is that Cha-Cha's an activist, one of which is that she's been on our podcast, one of which was that I posted a photo of her from the Pulse magazine in the show notes on the Pie and Coffee blog. This fact apparently proving I don't know what. One was that
– well, it proved that everybody who was on a busy Millbury Street at that time of day on that particular day must have all been in.
I don't know. The other facts don't make any sense either. So it's, this is why I think it's a great post, though, because he does sort of lay out his facts one at a time, which he normally doesn't do. He normally just sort of writes for a while, and then his caps lock key breaks, and it's all in capital letters. Well, I wanted to make one comment about the Telegram and Gazette, which we've been talking about in recent weeks, especially how their circulation and their advertising revenue is falling apart, which worries me because I think it's nice to have a daily newspaper. And the way things are going, it looks like this is going to be less and less the case. In the last month, we've had three telemarketing calls to our house trying to sell us subscription to the New York Times, expanded subscription to the Boston Globe, and a subscription to the Telegram and Gazette. And every time, my first initial reaction was to say, you know, why would I'm interested in the news. Why would I possibly want to subscribe to your newspaper? Which sounds like a really weird and insulting thing to say, which is why I didn't say it. I blew them off in a different way. But the more I was thinking about it, I realized that this actually connects into something that Bruce Sterling said at the South by Southwest conference last year. And he was talking about television.
Broadcast TV, which, of course, nobody watches. I mean, if you really like TV, you buy DVDs. And if you're really interested in TV, you have satellite TV, so you can see other people's TV. And if you're even lower on the evolutionary scale than that, at least you have cable TV. Whereas broadcast TV is for the semi-educated, the shut-ins, you know, and it's just become a kind of lower end, just kind of, I don't know, an evil medium that debases even the poverty-stricken people who watch it. But needless to say, well, it's true and we all know it. It's just kind of obvious. Did you turn on a TV? You know, have you watched broadcast TV? You know, I mean, it was bad before American Idol and, you know, and the rest of it. And now there's sort of no budget left there even to put on an enterprise with the dubious effects of Dallas, you know, which was at least globally popular and kind of exciting for its time and place. Broadcast television is an archaism.
And I think something similar is true, or is becoming increasingly true, about the newspapers, at least a newspaper in the same situation as the Telegram and Gazette, which is that if you're really serious about the news, just subscribing to the Telegram and Gazette is not going to cut it, right? I mean, there's neither the depth nor the timeliness that you're going to get from the internet or maybe, you know, NPR. Maybe I don't watch enough television to know how the cable news stations are doing these days. But it seems like if you're serious about news, subscribing to the newspaper, considering you can already get it online, doesn't make any sense at all. If you're serious about the news, you're getting it off the internet. If you're less serious about the news, so it's like, it's certainly not, there's certainly plenty of smart, educated, really engaged people who still subscribe to the newspaper. But it seems like that's becoming less the case rather than more the case.
The one thing about, I want to say this about this.
What's that, Bruce?
One thing is really funny when you look at the paper, there's like half the stuff in the paper isn't what really what happened. They're just putting that stuff in there just so they can, because they get some unemployed or dropped out of school people looking to sell newspapers, and they write the first thing that comes to mind. I mean, half the stuff may not even really happen, which a lot of it doesn't happen. It's kind of like the National Enquirer. I mean,
you know, my one thing that I keep noticing that seems to be happening more and more frequently with the Telegram, and this is a non-scientific study, you know, to the utmost extreme, but you know, Dan Savage, who runs The Stranger, it's an alt-weekly up in the Northwest. I think it's Seattle, actually, where it is. But he always refers to newspapers and their dying, and their struggle as being like donut papers. You know, like they're based in a city, but they really cater to the outskirts of the city, and like it seems that they cater more to the suburbs than the city proper, because that's where the aging populations that actually read newspapers tend to migrate out to as they get older. And one thing that I keep noticing with the Telegram is that their front page news seems to reflect just that more with greater frequency as we go forward. Like, there are more front page stories that are referencing, you know, Worcester suburbs as opposed to Worcester proper, which is kind of interesting. Like today, you know, I mean, I'm looking at online, but the Above the Fold story after the one big national story is a guy getting hit by a car in Phillipston and getting killed in Phillipston. It's weird that have we run out of news in Worcester? Like, is it a Worcester newspaper anymore, or is the Worcester Telegram and Gazette just the title, and it's actually a suburban newspaper catering to, you know, to South County and, you know, the western towns?
I think Jeff Barnard was right when he told us that there are no top stories in the city of Worcester. That it's basically I mean, most of the days there's not like some overwhelming two or three things that are going on. Most of the days it's like, are we going to run, you know, the story? Are we going to run this crime story on the front page? Are we going to run some weird analysis piece on the front page? It's just kind of up in the air. It doesn't really matter.
I got a question for you.
Yes, Bruce.
Well, actually, it was like when we were talking about the bus schedules and the train stations and stuff like this, and this is like kind of like an interesting thing, because if someone's like had to go to the hospital, like they feel rather if they live in Auburn or like in Holden or something like that, they all come to Worcester. I mean, this is like if you have to go to court, it's like had to go to court here, it's like you got to go all the way from like Auburn, because like all these surrounding towns have like courthouses or frozen like hospitals or anything like that. You got to come to Worcester. I mean, it's just like if Worcester didn't have a courthouse, you had to go to Boston. And that's another thing, another perfect example right there. This stuff, none of this stuff makes any sense. It's kind of like the same thing with a bus terminal, bus schedules and stuff.
Well, I feel like unfortunately we've had a negative show today, but next week it will change. Next week will be all positive news. I have, like I said, I have a good feeling about getting some great new panelists next week. So.
Well, here's a positive thing.
Lay it on us, Bruce.
Well, next week when you want to have something positive, well, I just want to just bring up that, grab that Pulse magazine. You know, we could have some focus on something positive.
Thanks, Bruce. And Brendan, thanks to you also for being on the show this week. I'll talk to everyone in 7 days.
Thank you.